Hello, everybody. I'm Carolyn Waters, a head librarian, although most of you know that already. I'm so happy to see you all tonight. As most of you who have been invited to these parties in the past couple years know, we have terrible luck with the weather. I think a couple years ago, we had to cancel it and rescheduled it, and then last year we had it on the day after a major blizzard, and you know, we're having some kind of apocalyptic nor'easter. So I am really doubly thrilled that you all braved the elements to come out tonight. Because all of you in this room are incredibly special people to the library. Your generosity makes so much possible here. You know, all of the fantastic books that we add to our collection, all the new services we add, the e-books, the electronic resources, the maintenance of our building, all the programs and services, everything we do here is really a testament to the work that you've done to support the library and everything you do here. So we are really, truly grateful. And so on behalf of all of the members, the staff, and the trustees, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you very, very much. We really do appreciate it. So the theme of tonight's evening is Washington Irving. As you all probably know by now, he's not only a member of the library, but a trustee. And we have a number of items that Laura O'Keefe, our head of cataloging and special collections, and Alexander Brown, our archivist, have pulled aside for you to take a look at. Things like the 1837 charging ledger, which is always really fun to have pulled out to take a look at, and a first edition of Irving's History of New York. So please take a look if you haven't already taken a look at that. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for the evening, and I want to thank Dr. Elizabeth L. Bradley very much for coming out on such a terrible, terrible night, and also because she's been battling a terrible cold all weekend. So we are really, really thankful to have you here. Dr. Bradley is the author of Knickerbocker, The Myth Behind New York, and Cityscopes New York. We have copies up here. She's the editor of the Penguin Classics edition of Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Other Stories, and Irving's A History of New York. And she has contributed to the Cambridge Companion of the Literature of New York and the Encyclopedia of New York City. She's written about New York history, preservation, and culture for The Observer, Salon, Smithsonian, and the New York Times. And she serves as a consultant for Historic Hudson Valley, whose properties include Irving's Tarrytown home. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Elizabeth L. Bradley.
Thank you very much. If you can't hear me, just wave, shout. I'll try and speak more loudly. I do have a little bit of a cold. I have to say, first and foremost, it's thrilling to see Irving's page in the ledger. Is it the ledger or the log book? The ledger. Because my godmother was a member here. She's moved to New Hampshire. But she used to always complain that every book she wanted to tick out had already been checked out by Adele Auchincloss. And I guess she could tell because she could see it in the ledger. Lots of wailing and gnashing of teeth. So thank you very much, Carolyn, and to all of you. I'm happy to be here and thankful to you for braving the weather as well. I'm not entirely going to talk about Irving in New York because he, strangely enough, did not love being in New York City. He loved to write about New York City. It makes it complicated for us trying to interpret his home at Sunnyside, but hopefully it'll be interesting for you tonight. So according to Wiki Answers, Washington Irving is the father of the American short story. I thought I'd start with something that would really set librarians' teeth on edge. While Irving, a lifelong bachelor, might have been tickled by this paternity suit, I'm not sure that he would have appreciated this glib assumption. To be the father suggests that other 19th century American writers are the actual masters of the form. It's a kind of backhanded compliment. So I can already guess what names might be leaping to your mind. Poe, Hawthorne, Twain, maybe Kate Chopin, maybe Henry James, or Stephen Crane. And that always seems to be the way with Irving these days. It's his name in parentheses. He's the prequel, or the run-up. Say, yes, of course, Irving, and then the fun began, right, in 19th century literature. But I'm here to say that the fun began with Irving, because he gave us the original American dreamers, Rip Van Winkle and Ichabod Crane, and he set their delicious fantasies against a truly transcendental backdrop, the fairy mountains of the Catskills. And it was these which prodded Americans, gently but firmly, to see ghosts and dream dreams of their own. And if you've ever looked at Irving's letters, you'll know this is true because of the volume of young authors who sought his approval, and that included Poe and Melville, among others. His own New York tales transformed a new country into an ancient wilderness that he layered with meaning and stories. Before Thomas Cole ever made his way up the river, Irving was the Hudson River School. So he also brought the American frontier to life for readers without steam engines, seduced Americans into a love affair with the Alhambra, and was a crusader for authors' rights and copyright protection centuries before the Authors Guild. He dubbed our city Gotham, and he may, with apologies to Clement Clark Moore and Thomas Nash, have invented Santa Claus. And so no one would fault me for stopping there, but I revere Irving for another innovation, and that is the history of New York, which made him famous at 26 years old and gave us a narrator like no other. That was Dietrich Knickerbocker, who was a grumpy know-it-all with a fondness for street food and deep roots in the neighborhood. In other words, he was a real New Yorker. During Irving's lifetime, Knickerbocker was the genealogist of the Hudson River Valley, studying the genuine Dutch families, as he liked to call them. And he was the narrator of every Dutch tale that you hold dear from your childhood. But he also took flight from Irving, and he became a thing unto himself, a kind of emblem or a signifier. And I want to talk a little bit about that tonight. So as you probably noticed, the name of Knickerbocker hovers at the edges of New York City life. You can find New Yorkers on Knickerbocker Avenue in Bushwick, in Knickerbocker Village on Cherry Street, at the Knickerbocker Grill on University Place. They might belong to the Knickerbocker Club on Fifth Avenue or the Knickerbocker Field Club in Flatbush, Brooklyn, send their children to the Knickerbocker Cotillion or to march in formation with the Knickerbocker Grays in the Armory. They might weep over the fate of the New York Knicks or buy stamps at the Knickerbocker Station Post Office, which is in Chinatown. And we've even called some notable New Yorkers Knickerbockers. You think of someone like Schuyler Chapin or George Plimpton, that nickname, that moniker seems to stick. So where does the word come from and what does it mean? Well, as I've said, Dietrich Knickerbocker was the fictional narrator of Irving's first book, and it had a much more unwieldy title than what Carolyn gave it, because she was being kind. It's called A History of New York from the Beginning of the World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty, containing, among many surprising and curious matters, the unutterable ponderings of Walter the Doubter. This sounds better when I don't have a cold. The disastrous projects of William the Testy, and the chivalric achievements of Peter the Headstrong, the three Dutch governors of New Amsterdam, being the only authentic history of the time that ever hath been or ever will be published. It's kind of a lot. But this book was a near instant success, despite the title. It's like something that only David Foster Wallace could think of. And it brought this young author fame on both sides of the Atlantic. It was hailed as America's first homegrown satire, which shows you how tastes have changed, because the book is peculiar and demanding, and it's thick with digressions and footnotes. It's almost, if you like Moby Dick or Tristram Shandy, this is a book for you. And it's narrated by this self-described, crabbed, cynical, impertinent son of a Dutchman. So why did American readers and why did New York readers take to it? It was irreverent when it should have been pious. It was anarchic where it ought to have been orderly, and melodramatic where it really should have been academic. Remember, there was no history of New York at this time. There was a history of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. New York had no written history. But this book gave New Amsterdam back to New Yorkers who had only just freed themselves from the yoke of British occupation, 7 years of occupation. And New Yorkers loved Irving and Knickerbocker for resurrecting this happier colonial history. From the beginning of Irving's book, it's clear that the history exists pretty much just as a soapbox for its narrator, Dietrich Knickerbocker. He's descended from the Dutch colonists, as he said, and he proclaims himself a member of the only local nobility in New York. which is I love the idea of nobility in New York. It's sort of both very, very New York and also very anti-democratic. But if our snobbish little historian is obsessed with genealogy, his author has a much cannier agenda. So as Knickerbocker spins out anecdotes about the founding of New Amsterdam and the comic behavior of its governors, Irving includes details that point to the Dutch origins of contemporary New York. Things like the Dutch cows, Knickerbocker tells the reader, were actually New York's first city planners, because they took it upon themselves, as he said, in a fit of laudable patriotism, to wander to and fro in their grazing, thus creating the jigsaw geography which we know as Lower Manhattan. Knickerbocker also insists we have Dutch settlers to thank for the coffee cart staple, the donut. Our ancestors, he says, were fond of balls of sweetened dough fried in hog's fat and called donuts or oily cakes. If you put it that way, it doesn't sound so tasty, does it? And he also endows his New Amsterdamers with the live and let live attitude that New Yorkers pride themselves on today, although he credits it more to their phlegmatic Dutch temperament than to any spirit of universal tolerance. But in his quest to impress the importance of these contributions on readers, Knickerbocker issues some very important warnings against the dangers of forgetfulness. Without his work, remember this satirical, semi-fictitious work, Knickerbocker insists, the origins of New York will be buried in eternal oblivion. Every time I read that threat, I hear another voice, and sometimes it's Shelley, it sounds like Ozymandias, and sometimes it sounds like Melville's Ishmael saying, I alone am left to tell thee. But then you have to remember that neither of these books was written when Irving published this in 1809. This threat really did galvanize New Yorkers. They were looking at their rapidly growing city and looking for a kind of past that they might all share, something that would be radically different from the British colonial inheritance that they had just violently rejected. So here are Irving's rollicking tales of New Amsterdam, which blend fact and fiction, and they offer readers the collective memory and set of urban traditions that had really eluded them until now. It didn't seem to matter to readers that Irving was not Dutch himself, he was English and Scottish, or that he'd borrowed the Knickerbocker name from a Dutch family living in Scaghtikoke who hadn't exactly given their permission, or that his work also could be read as a satire of Jeffersonian democracy. Instead, the fictional Dutchman who presented this rosy and sometimes ridiculous glimpse into the city's past was immediately adopted by New Yorkers as their first bard and mascot. Knickerbocker quickly became, as Irving noted later with pride and not a little wonderment, a household word. And it really didn't stop there, and what I'm going to quickly go through for you are some of the social and political and cultural ways in which New York's transformations can be mapped across competing incarnations of Knickerbocker. The multiplying Knickerbockers gave all different kinds of New Yorkers ways to make sense of their city. And to continue this project of collective history that Irving insisted upon. So I have to say that within 5 years of the history's publication, just to give you an idea, city dwellers could patronize multiple Knickerbocker bakeries offering Dutch New Year's cakes made in the true Knickerbocker style, whatever that might be, because it's fictional. You could go to Mott Street or William Street for those. Or if you had a little more cash, you could buy a share in the Knickerbocker packet ship, which was carrying rum from Jamaica. You could visit the American Museum and see a rowboat built for speed and christened Knickerbocker. Or enjoy beefsteaks, oysters, and relishes of every description at the shortest notice at the Knickerbocker Hotel, which was on Little George Street. So New York had already embraced Knickerbocker, and it had already made it a New York word. But this transformation didn't take place without Irving's assistance. As a result of the success of the history, he dropped his legal studies pretty much without hesitation, and ultimately moved to England. He spent time both in England and served in the War of 1812, and then went back to England, where he wrote three volumes of atmospheric sketches that started with, with the sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, which is where you can find The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and Rip Van Winkle, his most famous stories. These pastoral vignettes and mostly very Anglophilic rhapsodies caused the English magazine Blackwood's to assert that Mr. Washington Irving is one of our first favorites among the English writers of this age, and he's not a bit the less so for having been born in America. meant to be an American writer at that time. It didn't mean very much. It didn't stand for very much. But tucked among all of these Anglophilic rhapsodies and odes to the old world were these subversively American tales, and they were further adventures of Knickerbocker. The chronology of the stories roughly picks up where the history left off, and it follows the fate of the Dutch settlers under English rule and into the first years of American independence. If you remember, Rip Van Winkle, for example, wakes up after the Revolutionary War has been completed. He just has no idea. King George is gone from the tavern door, and instead it's George Washington. There are some other stories which I would recommend to you that also have Knickerbocker as their narrator. They're less famous. I can tell you about them afterward, because I'm sort of evangelizing for them, because they're wonderful and they don't get the attention that Rip and the legend do these days. I think what's so interesting about Irving's additional tales of Dutch New York is that he used Knickerbocker's nostalgic worldview as a platform from which to comment on the transformations that were happening both in his native Manhattan and beyond. And this was happening right in his own front door at Sunnyside at this point as well, as the railroad drove its tracks right by his house. He was seeing the growing street grid in the city, which took place after he began writing, the excavations of the Erie Canal, the introduction of something as simple as gas lights and sewers. All these things were happening because New York was just that new. I won't speak at length about Irving's Knickerbocker stories, because I like to think you probably know them better than most audiences, but each of the stories took pains to enumerate the characteristics of what Knickerbocker called a genuine Dutch family, much as an anthropologist might outline the cultures and customs of a lost tribe. And this is something that we see Morton doing later on in her stories of old New York. The story suggests rather mischievously that some of New York's contemporary grandees, who were at that point starting to tout their colonial ancestry, might not be so grand. Knickerbocker's Dutch heroes often find that their family trees don't count for very much in a post-Dutch New York. And the ability to convert their inherited Manhattan farmlands into snug tenements is really, really what helps them out. It's all about real estate. And I think that real estate is something that Irving was thinking very deeply about, and it's one of the ways in which we see the manifestations of Knickerbocker throughout the city, because what was happening in the city that Irving himself had fled was that the transformations on account of immigration were really overwhelming. It was like nothing that any New Yorker born when Irving was in 1783 could have anticipated. The population of New York County more than tripled between 1800 and 1830, and by 1855, nearly half of the city's more than 600,000 residents were foreign-born. And so what you see here is that Knickerbocker is going to become a way for people to make sense of what it now means to be a New Yorker, which is very different from what it meant in 1809. This kind of boom really strained New York's municipal resources, and it revealed some of the prejudices of the city's self-proclaimed natives and led to the riots and clashes that primarily involved the poorest and newest New Yorkers, and revealed the kinds of fissures that divided the city and have so much to this day. So as New York changed, so did Knickerbocker. His ancestral snobberies were heightened by some of his invokers in seeming reaction to this wave of newcomers. And his employment as a kind of memory device took a very exclusionary turn. He was called on to be the muse of a genteel literary magazine, to whose pages Irving occasionally contributed when the fee was high enough. He was pressed into service by gaslight writers such as George Foster, who used Knickerbocker as a very obvious synonym for patrician and a shorthand for elite and white. In a similar vein, but I think more interestingly, the Civil War era Metropolitan Fair, which was a fundraiser for the Sanitary Commission, christened its major fundraiser after Irving's narrator. It was the Knickerbocker Kitchen. It was an enormous restaurant that dispensed fine cuisine in an atmosphere of pitch-perfect nostalgia. As the newspapers reported, the ladies who helmed the Knickerbocker Kitchen Committee were descended from the oldest Dutch families in the state. I guess you couldn't do it if you weren't. And thanks to their careful attention, you could consider the Knickerbocker Kitchen a kind of Hard Rock Cafe for historians, because it was a curatorial marvel. It was a complete replica of an 18th century farmhouse with an open hearth and exposed beams, tables set with vintage Delft china, and actual Dutch heirlooms on loan from patrician families. And if you wanted to, you could have paid for your meal at the Knickerbocker kitchen with a Knickerbocker token. These were coins stamped with a portrait of a man in colonial dress, supposed to be Knickerbocker, framed by the words Knickerbocker currency. They were one penny pieces that were among many privately minted coins that were made by Union merchants during the war, when monetary metals were scarce and there were competing currencies across the states. But regardless of how guests paid for their bills, the restaurant grossed over $12,000, more than $1.3 million for the Union cause. And thinking about it, the kitchen's popularity can't be due entirely to New Yorkers' nostalgia for oily cakes. I think the real appeal was this highbrow patrician atmosphere, which refined the homely landscape of Knickerbocker's Dutch ancestors and made the cows and cabbages into something a little more aristocratic and ceremonial. After the Civil War, Knickerbocker took on yet another role. He became not only a city mascot, but New York's paterfamilias. And this is where I do wish I had slides, because there were in all the newspapers wonderful caricatures of Father Knickerbocker. And he was used to show the city in dispute with Tammany Hall. He was seen fighting the Tammany Tiger. He was used to adjudicate the consolidation of 1898, which is when what we know as the five boroughs of New York was consolidated into Greater New York. Did you know that Brooklyn was a rival to New York long ago as well as now? So, for example, when they were trying to consolidate, you'd see Father Knickerbocker with his great cap, like some sort of elegant, more refined hybrid of Thomas Jefferson and Peter Stuyvesant, wooing Miss Brooklyn, and then after the consolidation, he's seen chastising Little Brooklyn, who has been reduced by the. But the wooing image is wonderful because it takes place across the span of the recently completed Roebling's Brooklyn Bridge. Just a wonderful, wonderful way to kind of capture the century. And I think that this idea of capturing the century with Knickerbocker was something that was understood once again by marketers. I mean, everyone from John Jacob Astor, who christened the Knickerbocker Hotel in 1905, to Rupert Beer, which took out a patent for near beer not long after Astor did, to Charlie Knickerbocker, who some of you may have heard of, the darling of the society pages. Everyone seemed to find a way to take the patrician edge off of Knickerbocker and make it their own, or what they perceived in the Gilded Age as this patrician edge. But at the same time, there was also Knickerbocker Village, which was erected in the 1930s. It's a housing project on the Lower East Side that was designed for working class New Yorkers, new immigrants. And among its very first residents were Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who lived there until they were taken to their sentencing. And you could also be, at the same time, a Knickerbocker Democrat if you were a support of FDR's New Deal. FDR himself, of course, having a Roosevelt, the ultimate Knickerbocker, and giving the land for the Empire State Building. And finally, some newspapers even took to referring to the state government at Albany as Pa Knickerbocker, but never in a very flattering way. And what's interesting is now, even as Irving's stories by the middle of the 20th century are ceasing to have the same kind of currency they did during his lifetime, Knickerbocker still finds a way to hold on. And for this, we really have Madison Avenue to thank, because the 1950s saw Knickerbocker floating above you at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, Knickerbocker welcoming you to both New York World's Fairs, and Knickerbocker being portrayed by a series of actors for Rupert Brewery. It's interesting that the last incarnation of Knickerbocker we have today is the one that has the least association with Dutchness, and that has to be the New York Knicks. I was fortunate enough to interview Bill Bradley about this for my book. We're not related. He kept saying, aren't we related? I said, no, nobody in my family is very tall. But he said, even though he's a Princeton grad, he's a smart guy, he said, I had no idea what Knickerbocker meant. I just knew it had something to do with New York. And if you look on, if you read it up on the history of the Knicks, and if you look on their website, you'll find That, in fact, is true of their entire decision. They were among the earliest franchises in the Basketball Association, and while other founding teams were choosing names that reflected the geography or the primary industry or the ethnography of their city, so you have the Pittsburgh Ironmen, you have the St. Louis Bombers, these are the original teams, the Boston Celtics, for example, New York's franchise chose Knickerbocker. So what does this mean? We have all these competing incarnations that we've been thinking about. It doesn't mean that beer is the chief import of Manhattan. That would be the only other competing Knickerbocker at the time. But it meant, as the present-day NBA insists, that the Knickerbocker character was synonymous with New York City. And Father Knickerbocker was New York's most popular symbol. It's very strange to me, and yet kind of wonderful, when you think about Irving's joy in the fact that his little mascot had become a household name, that it should come around to something as a-literary, for lack of a better word, as a basketball franchise, to tell us yet again what the meaning of Knickerbocker might be. And indeed, there was a Father Knickerbocker image. The same cartoonist who drew the Brooklyn Bums, a guy named Willard Mullen, very famous, created a basketball dribbling Father Knickerbocker wearing a lace jabot and knickered pants and buckled shoes and, of course, the tricorn hat. The team, thankfully, was not required to wear the same costume, but they do wear orange, blue, and white. But still to this day, the Westchester branch of the New York Knicks, that is their mascot. They still have them. And I'm sure there is not a single person who follows that team who has any idea why. So to conclude, some may argue that Irving's borrowed name, as you've seen from this devolution, has finally become almost just like a Dutch-inflected sound. You know, it's a New York utterance. We know it means New York. We have no idea why, and we're kind of not curious enough to inquire. But I would argue that, in fact, New York Knickerbocker has not outlived its meaning. I think it might actually be the Little Dutchman's moment, because the chief message of this historian is still the very idea of New York, of capturing the memories, of rescuing the knowledge, and the questions of history and communal identity that preoccupied Irving are just as crucial more than 200 years after Knickerbocker's anniversary as they were of its creation. We still look for these reminders of our shared past. We're still trying to prove that we are real New Yorkers. And I think as New Yorkers continue this project of reinvention that's always been our calling card, we can't really do better than to return to this name that Irving bequeathed to us. So we may not choose to cheer on the Knicks, but as readers and writers and as New Yorkers, I think we must always salute the Knickerbockers. Thank you, and I'll take your question. Like to read challenging books, it's worth it. Someone's shaking their head over there. It's absolutely worth it. It's a lot of fun. It's very silly and a little bit scatological. Yes, is there a question?
Were the Yankees originally known as the Knickerbockers?
The Yankees?
The New York Yankees.
There was a New York Knickerbocker baseball team, which I didn't go into here. They were the first organized team, although there is, among baseball historians, and I'm certainly not one, there is a good deal of debate. It was an Alexander Cartwright organized team, and they were the first. They were known for being very courteous and for hosting their opponents and, you know, carousing afterward, which I think seems very much like Irving's Dutchman. But they were not. I don't believe they were the. I don't think there's a lineal connection to the Yankees. I think the connection might actually be to the Mets, if I'm right.
I think Rupert, okay, who owned the Yankees. Okay,
that's correct. Rupert,
right, he had his beer, right, called Knickerbocker.
Yes.
And he wanted to name the baseball team the Knickerbockers, and people were persuaded him, well, you know, that might not
go over that well,
and that's how he came up with the Yankees.
I think because there was an original team from the 1840s that were the New York Knickerbockers that, if you go to Cooperstown, they know all about them, but I knew that Rupert owned the Yankees, but I thought one thing was interesting about his choosing the Knickerbocker name was that at the time when Rupert's brewery was at its busiest was when a lot of German brewers were being boycotted by Americans because it was during World War I, and you weren't supposed to import wheat, and it also was seen as very unpatriotic to drink beer with German sounding names. And
right.
I thought perhaps Rupert's family was originally German, and Knickerbocker seemed to me like a wonderful way to situate yourself, you know, as being as New York as possible, you know, kind of American in a very patrician way. But that's very interesting about wanting to rename the Yankees. That would have been a branding mistake. Any other questions? Thank you very much.